Bonjour. Je veux donner la présentation en français parce que nous sommes un pays avec deux langues officielles. Mais à mon part de le pays, les gens presque parlent anglais. Presque. Et le français, pas du tout. Donc, mon français est trop pauvre pour donner la présentation en français et je dois parler en anglais. OK? But I believe in a bilingual country. Although there's many people back home that, like I said, they barely speak English. And I have to say to Matt, I got a chuckle when you showed the three laws of Kraft, Erica, because Beethoven had written in his sketchbook the starry skies above us and the moral law within us. So reflects very much the same type of outlook. Okay, now I'm standing in front of this right now because I got my notes to myself and I don't want you to read them. I didn't correct the spelling or anything. But I may proceed somewhat slowly in this presentation because I was constantly rewriting it, thinking it through. Because I will try to get across some of the most profound music, well, that's easy, that has ever been written and considered by many difficult to appreciate and understand. But I'm a firm believer that if the ideas are made clear, you can comprehend it. But I was thinking through how to do that. And I will say, I'm also a firm believer that when somebody makes a presentation on ideas in music, you should be able to hear the idea in the music, not just accept what I say and say, I guess it's there, but actually hear it. And since most of us don't have a really deep musical education, it's kind of like trying to understand something in a foreign language. So I'll just say from that standpoint that I'll proceed slowly, and I've lowered the number of examples that I'm using because if someone doesn't get it, just tell me and we'll go over it as many times as it takes to actually hear it, okay? Because that's where it gets really interesting is when you can hear it. Now, you just heard Donald Trump in a rather amazing presentation calling for the American system, a restoral of it. And I would say to people who say, a lot of people just say, well, I don't like Trump, I'm just not for him anyhow. And I would say that if you think that way, you're leaving our organization out of the equation. Because this organization immediately took the approach when we saw that Trump had the potential to succeed, but it could also fail, that it was our job and our duty to do everything in our power to make sure that he did succeed, because humanity depends upon it. And many of the things that you heard him say there reflect a change in thinking, and to my mind, I can't conceive him saying those things without the influence of the LaRouche organization, the cultural impact, both directly, but also over the decades that we've been working and developing these ideas. But also, if you just say something like, well, I like Trump or I don't like him, you're leaving yourself out of the equation because you're not asking yourself, what's the difference that I might make in this situation? And that really is the question that you have to ask yourself. If you do say that you don't see the difference, then probably it has a lot to do with the way that history is taught. The way we're taught history is boring and meaningless. If you take a history course, you'll remember some things that happened because you need to for the exam if you're going to pass the exam, and you might even memorize some dates because you also need them for the exam, though they don't mean anything to you. And you're asking yourself, well, wait a minute, was that 1750 or 1650? And you really don't have a good idea of the 100 years in between that. And thus, when people speak of history, they just coin the term, well, back in the day, that's what they said back in the day. But you don't have a sense of the continuity of history and how it actually develops. Also, you might learn something about what caused things to happen in history, but the explanation of these events is highly questionable. I just read an account where there are now historians who believe that a volcano is responsible for the French Revolution. In 1783, you had a huge eruption in Iceland of a volcano which spread ashes all over Europe, covered the sky, caused massive crop failure. The crop failure caused the peasants to go hungry, which caused them to rise up and overthrow the king. And that was the French Revolution, and that's where democracy comes from. So your democracy comes from a volcano. Now, where exactly does the individual fit his own activity into things like this that are just, you know, determined totally outside of you? You'll also learn that the way it's taught is that history has periods. Things happen in history because the time is right for them to happen, and that they will happen anyhow, and that if one individual who did something that changed history hadn't been there, someone else would have come along and did the same thing. President Lincoln ended slavery, but if he hadn't have been there, someone else would have come along and done it. Now, I'm not into promoting movies too much, but if you've seen the movie Lincoln, it makes a very clear case that Lincoln realized that the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves, was only a wartime act, an emergency wartime act, and that in times other than war, the question of slavery lied with states. And he says, if we don't get an amendment to the Constitution banning slavery, then when the war is over, the states will say the emergency is over. This is in our control again. And it shows the tremendous fight that he went through to get the 13th Amendment. It was considered almost impossible, but he did it. But I'll submit to you that if he hadn't have done it, we might still have slavery today. There's nothing in the stars. There's no period of history that says slavery had to end at this time. Likewise, was it inevitable that Hitler would be defeated? I mean, he played a major role in his own defeat. Because he was Hitler, he made a lot of stupid mistakes. If he had not stopped Guderian, the tank commander, when he was outside of Moscow in August, if he had not sent him south into the Ukraine, he would have taken Moscow before the winter set in. And that would have been the end. Russia would have lost. So he made a stupid mistake. But I'll also submit that on the other end, without a great leader like Franklin Roosevelt, the Nazis would not have been defeated. Not just because of the leadership role that Roosevelt played in the war, but that from 1933, the time he was elected on, his efforts to reverse the depression in the United States and the rest of the world, if that hadn't have taken place, then the United States and other nations would have not had the physical power to actually defeat the Nazis. So once again, without the action of heroic individuals, we might be living under Nazism today. And if you don't think Hitler had his sights on the entire world, take a look at Nuremberg and look at what he was tending to build in that place as the headquarters for the Nazi Empire. And there's no question about it. They were after domination of the entire world. So therefore, there's nothing set in history that says something had to happen at this or this particular time. And we can see that in the long term in several things that were known to the Greeks that were suppressed politically for, a good century and a half. For instance, in the 3rd century BC, Aristosthenes in Egypt, through a scientific experiment, was able to determine not only that the Earth was spherical, but he was able to determine its circumference within about a 1% margin of error. Now, you've heard how everybody up to Columbus believed in a flat Earth, right? That the Earth was flat. Well, no. Aristosthenes proved that so much to the extent. And now, in the year 230 BC, not AD, BC, an expedition took place under the leadership of Captain Rada and his navigator Maui. And unfortunately, what's happened here is they undertook an effort to circumnavigate the world. Okay? To circumnavigate the world. And this is the probable route that they took. No one's 100% sure. But you can see them leaving Egypt, going down, through the Indian Ocean into Indonesia. And it was there that the navigator Maui, in a cave, I think it was in Java, actually wrote down the scientific experiment that Eratosthenes had done to prove the nature of the world as a sphere and its circumference. So you can go to a cave in what was one of the most primitive areas of the world for a long time and actually see that experiment replicated. Now, when was the next time that somebody, they didn't make it all the way, because they knew the circumference of the Earth, but they didn't know exactly what they'd be running into when they got there. When was the next time that that was attempted?
When did this happen? 232 BC.
1,751 years later. That was when Magellan circumnavigated the world. So why was this not attempted in between? Well, there was another thing. Aristarchus of Samos, again in the 3rd century BC, and again in Egypt, it's something important to understand here, which is that... which one is it? Source?
No, equal blank.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. In the 3rd century BC, Aristarchus of Samos had a heliocentric model of the solar system. He knew that the Earth revolved around the sun, not the other way around. Now, we're told that the first person who discovered this is Copernicus, but again in the 1400s. But he not only knew that, he estimated the distance from the Earth to the sun, again, like Eratosthenes, fairly accurately. And it's interesting where these guys were, because we say they're Greeks, and but they're not, they're later Greeks. They're from Egypt after the campaign of Alexander the Great. And when he established Alexandria as the center of learning for the entire world. In fact, Eratosthenes was the head of the Alexandria Library, the one that was burned down. So here we have a situation where both the circumference of the Earth as a sphere and the heliocentric nature of the universe, of the solar system, excuse me, are known. But then it's like 1,700 years later before it comes back again. And they were suppressed. They were suppressed politically by Aristotle, who came in and said, no, the sun is not at the center of the solar system, the Earth is, and by Ptolemy in particular. Ptolemy, the ruler of Egypt, under the domain of the Roman Empire. So he's probably pretty surely working for the Romans. And this is done because they don't want the population advancing. They don't want the population to know the truth, to have science, to have culture. So you do things like that, and what you're doing is you're suppressing and stopping culture. So Ptolemy came out and said, not only is the Earth at the center of the solar system, but the planets move in perfect circles. Why? No proof. He says, well, God made the perfect circle is the most perfect form, and God would have made it any other way, so it's got to be the perfect circle. And you could not, in astronomy, get away with presenting orbits as anything but the perfect circle. So now, we'll see exactly where that got us. I'll get it. I want to show you something amusing here. This is what the planets would actually have to do in order to correspond to the model that Ptolemy imposed on it. Once again, with the Earth at the center and circular orbits. And it's very pretty, but not very practical.
So wait, what's the one closest that's the moon to the Earth?
Yeah. No, there's, you see the moon is, I think, a little black dot.
Oh,
this is the sun, the only one doing a perfect circle. The moon, and then Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, in that order. All of them are doing what were called epicycles. They can't just orbit in a circle around this around the Earth. So there, you see how they're doing loops there. And they're kind of tracing out a pattern, which is a pretty pattern. But imagine trying to launch a Mars landing with this model. Whoops! We're in the sun. It's supposed to be Mars. So, okay. There was also a Ptolemaic system. Oh, okay, I'll get it. Yeah. There was also a Ptolemaic system of music by the same person, Ptolemy. And what they had, earlier in the 4th century BC, some Greeks had known that you could not judge the intervals entirely by numbers, by ratios, and that your hearing had to play a role, and that the octave, the notes that the, which goes from the octave in which the same note repeats itself, like C and C at a higher level, they knew that that had to be divided into 12 equal tones in 400 BC. But what was done in music was a system was imposed saying that musical intervals had to correspond to rational numbers, fractions. So the ratio of a fifth was 3/2, the ratio of an octave was 2/1, etc. And that in fact, not only did an interval have to correspond to a rational number, saying that intervals had to correspond to rational numbers is very much like saying that planetary orbits had to correspond to perfect circles. It wasn't until Kepler actually discovered the true elliptical nature of the orbits that the model of the solar system and the actual behavior of the planets were not different. Under Ptolemy's system, you saw what happened. But it was the same with Copernicus, because he kept the circular orbits, and his circles were doing loop-de-loops too. Now, so they, and some of them went so far as to say, if they found a harmonic ratio in numbers, then that must correspond to a beautiful musical harmonic ratio, even if it was ugly, even if it was something absolutely impossible to sing, it had to correspond to that. And likewise, if something sounded good, if you couldn't find the numbers to justify it, it didn't exist. Therefore, mathematics determined the physics of music and not the other way around. Ptolemy's idea was carried forth several hundred years later, about 400 AD, by Boethius. And Boethius was the theorist who ruled over music theory for up until Bach, really. And I'm going to read you from his book on music and what he says. He says, there are three types of individuals versed in the art of music. One is the person who plays an instrument, another that composes song, and the third is the individual who evaluates the work of the performer and these songs. But those who are in the instrumental class and spend all their time there are excluded from the knowledge of the science of music and made servants, devoid of all reason and destitute of all speculative thinking. That's people who play music. The second class of individuals involved with music is that of the poet, who possesses not so much a propensity for thinking and reason as a natural instinct for song. And so this type of musician is also separated from music. So both the performers and the composers know nothing about music. Who does? The third class is that which has the capacity to judge. so that the rhythm and the melody, indeed the entire song, can be evaluated. Because this class is steeped in reason and thought, it can rightly be esteemed as belonging to music. That person is a musician who applies the faculty of reason and thought to what is fitting and appropriate for music with regard to modes and rhythms and the genre of songs and the mixing of sounds and consonances of all types, which will be explained later. So in other words, the people who play music aren't musicians, the people who write music aren't musicians, but the mathematicians who appreciate the mathematical ratios, just appreciate them, those are the musicians. Now, not surprisingly, not much polyphony got written in those days. Yeah, it didn't come along until much, much later. This was a stranglehold on music. And Kepler set out to defeat that. He knew that this idea that numbers are the cause of the intervals was absolutely wrong. And he knew that in rejecting the role of hearing, it was wrong. And here's just one of the things that he said in his breakthrough work, Harmonici Mundi, The Harmonies of the World, written in 1618. He said, if God had chosen numbers as his archetype, it would still not be clear why 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 conform to musical intervals, and 7, 11, and 13 do not. Since the terms of the constant intervals are continuous quantities, the causes which set them apart from the discords must be sought for among the family of continuous quantities, not among abstract numbers, that is, in discrete numbers, since it is mind which shaped human intellects in such a way that they would delight in such an interval. In other words, Kepler is saying the divine mind, and forget religion, he's saying that it is the intervals of love, the intervals have been that are used in creation have been placed in our minds, the consonances, so that they will move us with their beauty. So it's in mind that you find the consonant qualities of these intervals, not in abstract numbers. Okay? He says, all souls, spirits, and minds are in the image of God. Therefore, they rejoice in the proportions he had used and use the same in their own functions. It is the mind which discriminates consonant proportions from dissonant. Proportions are perceptible by reason alone, not by sense. To distinguish proportion of as form from that which is proportioned as matter is the work of mind. Okay. Now, the musical system that prevailed for so long, and there were different forms of it, I'm just going to show you one. This is the hexachord system. Which prevailed from about the 10th century, really up until Bach. And they had what they called, hexachord means six notes, instead of our seven note scale. They had what they called a natural hexachord, C, D, E, F, G, A, or Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La. They called it oud instead of Do back then. A hard one, which started on G, Sol, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La. Well, forget that. That was changeable. G, A, B, C, D, E. And a soft one, F, G, A, B flat, C, D. How many sharps and flats do you see in there? What? One. This was what was called musica recta, or correct music, true music, and it had one flat in it. Do you know what all the rest of the flats and sharps were called? Musica ficta, fictitious music. So this was the true musical system, and all the sharps and flats were fictitious. Now, they had to use them every now and then. They allowed them in. They allowed an F sharp in, and C sharp, and maybe an E flat, but that's it. You did not use the entire system of 12 tones as had been understood was necessary since the 4th century BC. Now, I'm going to give you an example of this, and it'll show you why Renaissance music, what the problem with Renaissance music is. Because this is a piece, and you'll see the score scrolling by as we look at it. This is the piece that was written for the dedication of the Great Dome of Florence in 1436. Now that dome by Brunelleschi was one of the major breakthroughs and accomplishments in the world. But ask yourself if this piece lives up to it. And my submission is not an inadequacy on the part of the composer. I think Dufay was a genius. It is like trying to work with a language that has a 50-word vocabulary and try to write a play out of it. And as you watch it by, you'll notice that it doesn't really change key. You can't do that. It's stuck in the same mode. You'll see the sharps and flats written on the side, but there's not many of them. And just tell me when you've had enough.
You're muted.
What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Here we go. Thanks. Hear the limitations in this? You want more, or do you get the idea? I get the idea. Okay. I was hoping someone would say that. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. We'll
but
come
it,
back.
It's really interesting the way you worded, though, that you acknowledge that this guy is a genius, but you're like working with, you're trying to compose poetry or a play or something with only 50 word vocabulary.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it, because it's undeniably beautiful.
Or maybe it's, what's that? Yeah, it's not that beautiful, but it's not up to the standard of the Dome of Florence.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's also, it gets boring. They did amazing things horizontally, cannons, inverted cannons, all kinds of stuff like that, that substituted for the fact that you couldn't really change key or anything like that. So, the composers, Forbach, and here's the interesting thing, for those of you who have heard of the C minor series, it's really part of the whole struggle to establish the true system. Because what you're hearing there is not the true system. It was the true system of the universe is a system of 12 tones and 12 major keys and 12 minor keys. And that was created before the first person whistled on a flute. It was a matter of discovering it, and like the true nature of the solar system, it was suppressed. And that's for, as Matt pointed out, what reason is there that we could not have landed on the moon 300 years ago if these ideas had not been suppressed? They were known, these things were known. And why did Bach have to do what he did in the 1700s? It could have been done a lot later. But if it hadn't been for Kepler and Bach, it also might never have gotten done. So there's nothing inevitable about it. So I'm going to play for you a couple of things here. This is what we call a diatonic scale, a major scale. Diatonic seems like a big word, but in Greek it just means through the tone, meaning it starts on one tone, C, and ends at a higher C. And people think of it as an eight-note scale because there's eight notes in it. But there's really only seven different notes, because the eighth one is a repeat, okay? Okay, you've all heard that, I think. And then there's another form of it, the minor scale. And this is the minor scale. And I use particularly the white note scales just to make a point, because those are the same notes as you have in the hexachord system, as I showed you. This is what's called the chromatic scale. This one right here. How many notes were in that? 12, yeah, I wrote it down. Yeah. The 13th note, like the other scale, the 13th note is a repeat. So there's actually 12 different notes. Those are all what are called half tones. The way that's represented on the piano is from one key to the next, whether it's to a black key or to another white key. It's just moving through each adjacent key. So the chromatic scale was one way for composers to investigate and make a point about the actual true nature of the system. They knew that that had to be the case. And before Bach, 100 years before Bach, really around the time of Kepler, you had people looking into this. Here, for instance, is a piece by an Italian composer called Frescobaldi. And see if you can hear that chromatic scale in there. I'll just play a bit of it. Can you all hear that?
Yes.
Okay.
It was like the first section, the first few notes that we played.
Yeah, and then it's in kind of a fugue with itself. But is it very interesting? Kind of limited. But it's a scientific experiment, and that's what's important about it. Because they're actually experimenting in how to create the actual nature of the real musical system as opposed to what has been imposed. And it's also a question of tuning, because the tuning with the using these rational numbers is also wrong. And you'll hear that in the next one. Is Pim in the room? Oh, there you are. Tell me how to pronounce this guy's name.
Zvili.
Okay. And how do you pronounce the Udekerke?
The which one?
The old church in...
Oh, the
Oudke. Okay. Yeah, he was the chief organist at the church, the old church in Amsterdam. It's interesting to me that Rembrandt was about 15 when he died, and everybody attended services there, so the young Rembrandt probably heard him play in that church. But he was known as the builder of organists. His students went to Germany, went all over northern Germany, and created the hotbed out of which Bach came. So there's a direct connection between Zweilinck and Bach. This is a fantasia, a chromatic fantasia by him, which is also exploring this. It's a good 100 years before Bach. But you can also hear that it's out of tune, because the question of establishing this system also involves the question of a tempered tuning. And actually, I have, there are performances that are much better than that. But again, don't just think of it as...
Pardon?
You gotta get any videos.
Oh, sorry. Okay. It's, again, don't think of it as just old music that seems kind of boring compared to what we do now, but see it as part of a scientific experiment with these guys trying to establish the actual system. Bach, in a very early piece, worked with exactly the same thing. This is his Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue. This is the fugue part.
Is he using the same tune?
Well, no, he I think, had established his own well-tempered tuning by this time. But if you listen to the fugue, you will hear that it's all based on using all 12 tones in half-tone steps. This is the end of the fantasy. Kind of taking it to an extreme. He really wants to make a point here. But I have to play you the beginning of this because he never did this quite again, but I think he was really a bit angry about what was going on because he really kind of goes a little bit overboard here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's fun, and I hate to stop it. But I think it's time to do what Matt said and go just back a bit and compare that to the earlier piece. It's a couple, 300 years earlier, admittedly. But this is the piece written for the dedication of the... And you saw all those sharps and flats, and he was going keys all over the place. Compare it to this. Okay, we don't need to do any more of that, but I mean, you see that Bach is working in a different universe, a different language than what we heard with the earlier stuff. Now, one of the other ways that the composers were experimenting in and looking into the entire idea of 12 tones was what is known as the circle of fifths. This is the circle of fifths here. This is actually an experiment done by the Pythagoreans in ancient Greece. This is our modern terminology for it. First of all, you know what I mean by a fifth? Okay. Sounds complicated. Here's the note C. Count up five notes. One, two, three, four, five. That's the fifth. It's the fifth degree of the scale. Okay, so five up from C is G. C, D, E, F, G. And even though it's written there, can somebody else please figure out what the next fifth will be?
D.
D. And then count up five from there. D, E, F, G, A. A, B, C, D, E. Because you only go to G and you start again at A. Up to B, and then up to F sharp. And then something interesting happens. F sharp, that's F sharp. This is G flat. They're the same note, especially on the piano. So let's start counting it in flats. We go from G flat to D flat, D flat to A flat, A flat to E flat, B flat to, and B flat to F, and then we're back to C. How many tones is that?
Sharps are represented by the hashtag symbol, and flats are...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. How many tones is that? You want to count?
12.
It's 12. So just by doing that, just by putting together 12 fifths and seeing that they end up at the same place, that was another indication that there were actually 12 tones. In the system, here's what it sounds like. Yeah, well, 7 octaves. Takes the whole piano, but what they did is they divided them by half or by quarters and put them all on the same scale. However, this is also, if Pythagoras actually did this, and it's hard to find out, I love it because he discovered the flaw in his own system. Because these are all... Say, if this is C at 2, then over 7 octaves you'd have C at 2, 4, 8, 16. You're doubling it. 32, 64, 128, 256, right?
Oh, if you doubled the frequency.
You're doubling the frequency because an octave is double frequency.
Okay.
And this covers 7 octaves.
Yeah.
So if you start at C, we'll call it C at 4. Then the next C would be C at 8, the next C would be C at 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. Now, the ratio for the fifth is supposed to be 3 over 2, 1.5. So who has a calculator on them, on their phone? Anybody?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and what is who?
I was going to stop there. It's ready.
Just start, take 4 as the first C, multiply it by 3 over 2, which is 1.5, and do that 12 times. And you should come up with 512.
So you take the first number, so the first C is 4?
Yeah, the first
divided by
1.5, which that should take you up to G.
Okay, multiply by 1.5.
Yeah. 12 times.
Right.
So multiplying by 1.5 should take you up to G, then do it again, it should take you up to D. And when you get through it 12 times, you should be at a multiple of 4, like 256 or 512, one of the frequencies for C.
518.9.
What'd you get?
518.9.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 512, but it's 518.9. This is what the Greeks called the comma. In other words, these ratios as perfect fractions are off. They're off. The 3 over 2 ratio is just a bit too big. And the reason why one of the reasons they couldn't write in all 12 tones during this whole period is because they were really trying to stick to those ratios, just like, you know, the astronomers were trying to stick to the circular notions of the planets. And therefore, you ended up getting an instrument that was not attuned in itself. I have a demonstration, but I won't do it now. I have a keyboard at home. You can just put it into these tunings. But what happens with them, you try to play something in C major, and it sounds fine. You try to go to A major, and it's completely out of tune. So you can't play in all the different tunes at the same time. Okay? So that's one way of... That's another way of actually conducting a scientific investigation of the true nature of the musical system. A scientific investigation and an attempt to establish it. Now let's go back to this. Here's the interval of a fifth, C to G. Now, we try a half tone above G, G to A flat, half tone beneath C, to B. Bach experimented with this long before the musical offering. In the Well-Tempered Clavier, which is 1722, he wrote a fugue that goes like... If you take the outside interval, A flat to B, that's called a diminished seventh, a very dissonant interval, which was also banned, of course. And when we get to Beethoven, I'll show you how that also reflects the investigation of the entire musical universe and an attempt to establish it. But for the meantime, let's look at... Bach's musical offering. And I really encourage people, even if you find it a little hard to follow at times, if you get 10% of it, you're doing good and you'll get the idea. Okay? But also, if somebody says, I don't understand something, just say so. And we'll slow down and we'll look at it again. Okay? Now, does anybody know the story behind the musical offering?
You know, the Bach visit the king, and the king asked him as a test, you know, of his genius to compose the music on the spot.
Right. The king was Frederick the Great, and he was a big fan of Bach's music. And his court musician was Bach's son, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. Okay, here we go. So he invited old Bach to come to the court one day and said, I'm going to give him a theme to really challenge him. And I sincerely doubt if he thought of it by himself. I think he probably went to Bach's son and said, give me something that's really going to give your dad a hard time. So he played this flute, this theme on the flute for Bach, and he said, I want you to make me a 6-part fugue out of this. And Bach said, well, I'll improvise a 3-part one for you right away. And he did. It's magnificent. And I don't know how many people could take a theme like this and just do that. He said, the 6-part one I'm going to have to work on a little bit. Here's the theme. And see if you can see how it relates to everything we've been discussing. Anybody?
He's inverting it.
What?
He's inverting it.
Well, just in terms of the basics, there's two ideas we've looked at. One was this idea of this interval, the diminished seventh. And the other was the chromatic scale descending by half steps. He's combined the two of them. There were composers who tried to, So he's looking at two different things that have been addressed separately. He's addressed them separately, individually, in different places. This is the first time they've really been put together. Okay? So it is actually something that it's exploring the true nature of the musical system and trying to establish it. Bach wrote the 6-part fugue and sent it to the king with a whole bunch of puzzle canons, which are just magnificent. Christine knows some of them. For the king to figure out, because he wanted to challenge him, and he said he gave him one voice, and then he gave him a little clue in Latin as to how to solve it. Seek and ye shall find, things like that. He gave him one that goes backwards and forwards at the same time, ones that turn upside down, one that turns upside down and go twice as fast, one that goes through all the keys and ends up through all 12 keys. He did all of that stuff. But his great accomplishment was to actually set this in 6 voices. So let's listen to a little bit of it. We'll just listen to a bit of it. And what I'd like you to do is just to hear it in its essence. Put your hand up each time you hear one of the voices enter, because they don't come in all the time. They're staggered. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So if you can hear it, just put your hand up when you hear another voice enter. There's one.